Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with My Science Hour, June 3rd, 2021. And if you haven't heard the news, UFOs are everywhere. They're above your house. They're above my house. They're above everybody's houses. They're flying all over. Everybody's seeing UFOs. All the congressmen are involved in it. They're all interested in everything they can know about UFOs. UFO, UFO, UFO. If you don't think they're priming the pump, the old information or disinformation pump, talking about UFOs, then like I said before, get your hip boots, get that, go to the store, the fishing store, wherever they sell hip boots, get the kind that come way up to your neck, because you're going to be wading in baloney, BS, up to your eyeballs regarding UFOs. It is thick and heavy, not to mention the latest thing, hackers are shutting down meat plants. Now let me see. You got people standing there, meat is coming along, they're cutting off certain parts of meat. Their job is like, how is hacking affecting shutting down a meat plant? Well, of course, it's absurd. Just like the pipeline, the oil pipeline, the fuel pipeline that was shut down weeks ago because of hacking. No, ain't possible. This is all garbage. And so I hope you're realizing that they're reaching for every straw in the straw box. They're pulling every rabbit out of the rabbit box because COVID's going away. Hey, Memorial Day, everybody went out, picnicked, visited relatives, take the masks off, no social distancing at the beach. Nobody's paying attention to the fear anymore. The fear, you got to fear the boogeyman, COVID. No, that's going away, so they need a new boogeyman to make you afraid. This is just becoming the new woke community. Oh, goodness, they're jumping on the bandwagon. They're going to solve the world energy problem with nuclear power because it doesn't give off carbon dioxide. Actually, it does a little bit, but that's not the point. The point is nuclear power is the most devastatingly horrific polluting energy source that ever was devised by man. It is horrific. There's no place to put the nuclear fuel. The fuel they're burning today requires cooling because when they spend the fuel, they don't, the entire latent heat from the nuclear fuel is not burned. It's not used up. And so there's some left over, but if you just put all of this in a place, it's going to continue building up heat. And so there, you have to get rid of this heat. What they did in Fukushima is they put it on the roof for the cooling towers where the warm air comes blowing through, but it was enough. It was cold relative to the heating rods that had been spent. They had 600,000. Now, just imagine this, a heating rod from a nuclear power plant, 600,000 of them went up in smoke, kapoofy, into the atmosphere when those babies melted down. Not to mention all the radioactivity and the heavy water and everything else in that reactor that went Chinatown, China syndrome. Well, how do you go China syndrome from Japan? It's just across the bay a little bit. China syndrome is from the United States because China's on the other side of the world. So maybe the Japanese might call it. Let me see. That's a good question. What is the other side of the world from Japan? If you pick up the globe and you put your one finger on Japan and you put your other finger on the other side of the globe, it turns out to be Rio de Janeiro. So the expression they should use in Japan instead of China syndrome, they should call it Rio de Janeiro syndrome. Where the melting of Fukushima power plants, nuclear waste, goes through the earth all the way, burns a hole all the way through the earth because nothing can contain it, and it ends up in Rio de Janeiro. So the Japanese would call it the Rio de Janeiro syndrome. In the United States, we call it China syndrome. But anyway, no, the idea that these Looney Tunes, La 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 Land, all over the place, wow, these people, they, you know, nuclear power is going to save us. Oh, goodness, isn't that wonderful? Don't ever talk about the nuclear waste. We don't want our little kids learning about that. But this is, as I said before, the General Electric Siemens plan all along. When you learn that those three-blade wind turbines that they've been selling 100,000 of them over the last 10 years put out there by people like Warren Buffett, who openly states they don't work, when the public wakes up and finds out that those babies don't work, doggone it, we got to get back to that good old nuclear power. And guess who does that at General Electric and Siemens? If you look at their webpage and you look at the proportion of business that they do with three-blade wind turbines compared to their core business of power plant generators, the wind alternative energy is just a little teeny pimple on the side of a pimple on the side of their entire business operation. Same with Siemens. Their core business is dealing with nuclear and central power companies in general. They have as many, let's take one of the GE propane, not propane, I'm sorry, natural gas generators. Looks like a jet engine. It's what it is. It's a jet engine with a two-stage converter for electricity at the end. Very good machines. They have probably about 20,000 of them out in the world. And they probably sold, oh, maybe 20,000 wind turbines. What do you think their main core business is? What do you think? The wind turbines? Not. Not. Anyway, yeah, this was the plan all along, and now they got all the woke little yuppies. I shouldn't call them yuppies. They're not yuppies. What do you call a 19-year-old college-age woke person? A wokey? How about wokey? Yep, just a nuclear power. Let's just all jump up and down. Like, these are the same people that are going to Mars camp and wearing their little backpacks and pretending they're walking around Mars. Yeah, the same people. Why am I laughing tonight? The world is in such a dire condition. It's such a mess. And I made the point on John Moore's show yesterday. First thing I said was, my goodness, we cannot hand the world off to the next generation or the next few generations that are coming along. And if you look at any major corporations, there's a high percentage of people that are still over 60, pushing 70 or more years of age. Because if you're in a real business, you need people that know how to do stuff. And that's all been lost. Anyway, not going to go there tonight. Tonight, I have a very special treat for you. Oh, ooh, this is a very special treat, too. I can't tell you what it is, but there's another. New things have been popping up relative to the Nazca lines. And so there's another thing that just came out this week. Fantastic, unbelievable, interesting, and I'll be pursuing this in the background. But that's one of the most interesting things. And of course, I made the major discovery back in 2015 and published it relative to the Nazca lines that they are fractal antennas. There's no question about it that they are a fractal antenna array. So anyway, just more on that coming in the near future. Tonight, I'm going to jump right into the main science topic. I'm going to be comparing electric versus hydrogen-based automobiles. And this is what triggered my interest here was this week, Toyota Mirai is how it's pronounced, is a hydrogen-based car, and they went 1,000 kilometers on a single tank full. Now, this is a little bit bigger tank than your average hydrogen tank on your average hydrogen car that's being sold today. So it was a bit of a modified car, but just shows you where things are going. And then they had a team of drivers. I think they had four drivers who traded off. And so they went a continual 1,000 kilometers. So that's 600 miles. Well, I'll tell you something. My car, I can get 600 miles on a tank of gas. It's a 20-gallon tank, and it's getting 30 miles to the gallon. I can get 600 miles on my tank with a gasoline car, burning regular gas, not premium. But still, that's a milestone because hydrogen is considered to be a much cleaner fuel. So anyway, that's interesting. But how do hydrogen and electric cars stack up topic per topic? How do they, if you look at all the different characteristics and also the infrastructure, how do they stack up? So that's what I'm going to be going through. And now this, if I were doing this, say, to a college lecture, this would be about 2 weeks worth of lectures daily, where we'd be going into the physics of the processes, the real numbers, etc. So this is going to be kind of a cursory introductory view of this. And so let me talk about first of all, the simplicity of the cars. The way they make, for example, a Tesla automobile, it's not really simple. There was a car, it was in a movie called The Italian Job. It was a heist, and it was done in, I think it was in Venice. But anyway, they had these British-made, I forget the name of the car, little, you know, they had these cars, and the one of the scenes, they have to drive through these subway tunnels. They're big, round, cement tunnels, and they're part of the sewer is not really the wrong word, flooding. When the floods come, they have to move the water through these big towers. But one of the scenes in the movie, these cars are zipping through the tunnels in Venice. And the Venetians would not allow them in there with a gas-powered automobile. They were afraid of an explosion. If these cars crashed and the gasoline caught on fire, and you know, they didn't want to take a chance on that. So they required them to have electric cars. So they got their engineers together, and they got what they called wheel motors. These are electric motors, about 100-plus horsepower per motor, and they just replaced the brake systems in this car, all four wheels. So the car had close to 600 horsepower. And then what they did is they took the motor and the transmission and all of that bulk from the gasoline car, and they put a battery pack, and I believe it was just 12-volt deep cycle batteries in the front. So it was fairly rudimentary, and these drivers get in these things. And so they have four-wheel drive, 600 horsepower in these little cars. And anyway, let me see. What is the name of that car? It was an Austin Mini Cooper was the name of the car. And these are they're very stout little cars, English-made, but 600 horsepower. I mean, putting that on this car. So anyway, that was a very simple car. Just a very simple car. And the brakes were in the motors, also in the wheel motors. Okay, so at any rate, when Tesla came along, I was quite surprised. They got rather complicated. And now a lot of the electric cars are using three-phase motors, which is a complication because then you need, in a lot of cases, some kind of transmission, kind of like those little kids' cars where you got a little electric motor and you got a little set of gears, sometimes a single set of gears, nothing complicated, but still it's more than just a wheel motor, which goes right in the wheel. The wires come in and that's it. Very simple. So people have gotten away from that simplistic car, and I'm not sure why. But then again, you have, for example, the Tesla has the battery down in the chassis along the bottom. And it's not what you would call easily replaceable. It's literally part of the car. And, of course, when some of these cars caught fire, you have this battery down there that just unloads internally, and that baby's going to burn until all of the energy is drained from that battery. But hydrogen in an accident is not going to be much better, although hydrogen has high-pressure tanks, and they're very sturdy. But anyway, simplicity in a hydrogen car, the way they're being built today, they're probably, I would say, equivalent in terms of simplicity or complexity, whichever. If you took a scale from 0 to 10, and 0 being most simple, 10 being the most complex, they're probably both in maybe the 7 range of complexity. And so in that respect, they're about the same in terms of manufacturing and production. Once again, about the same. In fact, the way they're building them, they're probably not a lot simpler than a gasoline-powered car, because gas cars have been around forever. The manufacturing process is pretty well down. And, I mean, a gasoline car, a nice modern gasoline car with a 18 or 20-gallon tank, getting 30 miles to the gallon is very common. And at a very generous price, I think the last car I bought was in the mid-$20,000, so $24,000, $25,000. Very nice car, very comfortable, you know, very nice on the road. Long road trips, very nice, four-wheel drive, etc. Like kind of not really an SUV, but cross between a car and an SUV. Very nice car, you know. But the people are trying to get away from gasoline is the issue. Okay, what about the fuel source? Now, if you look at the batteries in a battery-powered car, we're talking about a fairly significant piece of weight in the car. And that's a significant issue, because everybody's looking for this magical low-weight battery. It has not come about yet. In fact, some of the more modern versions of batteries tend to be pretty weighty. They're very heavy, like the very high-temperature batteries, and etc. Now, there was a time when people were converting regular automobiles from gasoline cars to electric. And, of course, then they were using deep cycle batteries. So a deep cycle battery is probably, let's say, a 200 amp hour rechargeable deep cycle battery, lead acid gel battery. In fact, that's the kind I sell with the wing generators. They're pushing 100 and maybe 150 pounds each. And so, and they'll have a total capacity of around 2.2 kilowatt hours of energy, the usable energy in them. And there again, if there's a battery experts out there, I know what you're going to say. You cannot get 2.2 kilowatts out of one of those. But anyway, these are, we could talk about that all day. But the amount of energy stored in a modern car, it's a fairly significant piece of equipment to charge up and be able to take that car for 300-mile distance, which they can do now. In the hydrogen car, you typically have a 4-kilogram tank. That means you have a weight of 4 kilograms of hydrogen in that tank. And, of course, it's pressurized. So now, in terms of charging up the electric car versus charging up a hydrogen car, you have a very similar set of parameters. And this is one of the downfalls of modern electric cars, and, in fact, hydrogen, is the fact that you have to have special equipment to charge them up. And even though one is electrical, it's the same principle, that you're trying to pump electrons into that battery, and the more electrons you get in there, the harder it is to get more electrons into the battery. And that's just the way it is. And so the same situation with hydrogen. There are different levels of charging for electric cars, something I happen to know quite a bit about because I sell car charging stations, along with the wing generator, etc. But the same situation with hydrogen. So not only do you have to generate the energy relative to getting the hydrogen or getting the electricity, as in the case of the car. But now you have to do a lot of work to just to charge the battery or just to pump the hydrogen into the tank. And it's the same way, let's take, for example, propane. You know, a lot of people are more familiar with a propane tank, that white steel, very solid tank that would sit in your backyard and have a propane feed going into some facility or maybe into your house. The amount of work it takes to pressurize these gases and move them and transfer them, etc., is really pretty awesome. I mean, it takes a lot of energy just to fill the tank. And so in a lot of cases, people don't really count that in their greenness, because in a gasoline car, you just take the hose, you put it in, the gasoline flows, it's a liquid at room temperature, and it just flows into the car. And so you're pumping it like pumping water in a tube, which really does not take a lot of energy. So the filling up of the battery, the filling up of the hydrogen tank versus filling up the energy, the gasoline going into a car, is really night and day. The gasoline car is hands down easier, and it's faster than in both cases. Actually, a hydrogen car, and that's one of the next points, is the time to charge the car. A gasoline car, you're there, if you got a 20-gallon tank, you might be there 5 minutes, you know, something like that, with the gas flowing in there, fill up the car, boom, done. Throw your credit card in the machine, drive away. Hydrogen is not much worse, and not too much farther behind. But now let's take the case of the Toyota Mirai, I have a hard time with that one, automobile that had a 20-kilogram tank on it to go the 1,000 kilometers. So I guess that's kind of cheating in a way, because if you put a big enough tank on any vehicle, you could get a certain distance out of it. But it certainly was making the point that it's about double what an average electric car will do. The average electric car is probably going to go 300 miles, the Toyota hydrogen car going 600 miles. But the time to charge and that effort is really something you have to stress. Now, what are you going to do when you get this home? Now, this is one of the big things that people talk a lot about, because an electric car, you can charge at home. Most people are probably not going to have a hydrogen generation plant, nor are they going to have a pump sufficiently strong to fill their hydrogen car at home. It's not commensurate with filling at home, but then again, neither is gasoline. The low charge time on a hydrogen car makes it more commensurate with gasoline and the distribution infrastructure that goes along with gasoline. So you could kind of imagine, as we might migrate into a hydrogen world, that the hydrogen pump would be right there, right next to the gasoline pump, or maybe a different area of the gas station you'd come in with your hydrogen car. But you're going to spend a few minutes there, not a number of hours. And this is one of the downfalls of cars, because here's the situation with, and this is the same with hydrogen in a sense, that if you try and charge hydrogen tank up very quickly, you're going to have a lot of heat generated, because you're compressing that gas, you're generating a lot of heat. And then that's wasted energy. That's heat energy going off. And nobody talks about this in their greenness. They forget about such things. But charging an electric car is going to take you, you know, if you have, say, a Tesla or another car that has an equivalent charge of 100 kilowatt hours of energy in it, which is where they're going, the bigger cars getting up to that level, then you're going to be there for quite a bit of time charging up that car. And so this is why, for example, on holidays, the charging stations are backed up for miles as people wait and other people get to charge up their vehicles at the charging station. So I just saw an announcement this week where Tesla is putting restaurants in at its charging stations to give people something to do rather than twiddling their thumbs while their car is charging up. But being in this industry myself of charging cars, the average person does not charge their electric car in the same way that you would a hydrogen or a gasoline car. What you typically do is you go shopping at the mall, so you'll get a two-hour charge there. That'll give you about 50 miles on your range. And then you go down the block and you go to the drugstore. And you might be in there for half hour, 45 minutes. So you plug in there, and then you get another 16, 18 miles charge on your car while you're at the drugstore. And then you go over to the shopping mall, or you know, maybe you go down to Home Depot. And this is the idea, that all of these locations will have charging stations everywhere. They're going to be everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. So that no matter where you go, you can plug in and charge up your car. And that's the modus operandi of the car charging station, the companies that are selling car charging stations. And I was going to consider selling to people in their houses. But here's the situation. You can charge your electric car with 120 volts, but you're not going to get much charge overnight. So if you have a range, for example, of over 20 miles that you have to drive in a day, you're not going to be able to charge your car at home with 120 volts, just like a regular plug outlet. You're going to have to jump up to a level 2 charger, which is a 7 kilowatt unit, which is wired to a 240 circuit. And this can be done in any house in the country, just about any house. Most houses have a 240-volt circuit that powers their house. It's called a split 240. And then you have two banks of 120, and that's what you divide up and send into the circuitry in your house. But you can take off the outside of that and have a full 240, and that's what the level 2 charging stations connect to. And there you could charge up your car, but now we're talking 7 kilowatts of power. And at, let's say, just say average, the national average, 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Now you're talking 7 times 10, 7 kilowatt hours times 10 cents per kilowatt hour gives you about 70 cents an hour. So if you're charging your car overnight, then you could have your car charged up, and it's going to cost you let's say 8 hours, so there's, you know, $5-6 or something like that. But there again, electricity is relatively inexpensive per mile when you start looking at electrical cars versus gasoline cars, especially with gasoline prices jumping up to $3 or maybe even $4 a gallon where you are these days. But remember that electricity is coming not from an alternative energy source. It's coming from coal, 98%. Or like the Tesla, you go into a Tesla charging station and they have some of the bigger ones that have a 250 kilowatt capacity, might have some solar panels on the roof. But if you look at the average, they might be doing maybe 2 or 3% of the power that's being produced at that site. Maybe 2 to 3% is coming from those solar panels. So really the vast majority is coming from the power grid. And that's one thing I want to change with the wing generator. If there are investors out there, get a hold of me, because this is a huge opportunity. But to power the car charging stations with the wind, which you can do with the wing generator because it's very efficient, unlike solar and unlike three-blade turbines monsters. Okay, so anyway, this is a big issue because this is where the public really sees these new vehicles for what they are. Infrastructure to swap batteries out never materialized, and that was one of the possibilities early in the electric car time, and this would have shortened the charging time. It is said that one out of every five drivers in California has gone back to gasoline because of the charging time. Now, in California, you have people are on the road. I mean, Anybody that goes less than 20 miles in a day in California, it's very rare. Most people live in their cars in California. And so charging a car extensively, if you have to spend 7 to 8 hours a day charging a car, even with a level 2 charger, you're spending a lot of time charging that car, and it's just not convenient. It's like having a horse, you know, that needs food every day, and you got to go out and feed it grain and then straw, and you got to saddle it up, and it's just, you know, it's a lot of extra work. So people have actually gone back to gasoline cars from electric cars because of the charging time. And one of the issues originally was, why not build an electric car with a battery bank where, kind of like the, say, a propane tank for your barbecue, you don't own the tank, you just take it back to the convenience store, trade them yours and get you a new one, and then that's what you do with propane tanks. And I don't like that idea. I don't like used things like that with high pressure in them. So I buy my own brand new, spanking new propane tank. I take it to the guy that fills it up. I pay the guy that fills it up, and I take my tank back home. Thank you very much. Because I just don't know, you know, I don't specifically trust that mechanism where you're trading your battery for somebody else's. But in the scenario where you're trading batteries at a gas station, the propensity would be for these batteries to be running out and people to be, wearing out, and then people would still be putting this battery in your car, and, you know, you would be trusting them. When you get gasoline, there are standards for gasoline, or the purity of hydrogen even, that are standards. These gasolines cannot sell you cheap gas with water in it, it's tested. There are people that go around and test all the gas stations all the time to make sure they're up to standards. But with the batteries, that would be a pretty big task, because the batteries would be at different, you know, levels of use. And how would they keep track of all this and charge customers an equitable price for a battery that's wearing out somewhere in the middle of its lifetime? So anyway, that idea where you would drive in and swap out the battery quickly never materialized. And there again, it's a big infrastructure problem. It's kind of like the same problem that car rental stations have. If you have people just stopping at random, it's different than gasoline. You're just putting gas in your car and you drive away. But if you're dropping off batteries, what if a gas station, like a rental car station, if you rent a car and you don't bring it back to the same rental facility, they're going to charge you a lot more because they don't want their cars all over the place. Those cars that you're renting there, they want to come back to their location. And if it ends up in Timbuktu and you rented this car and you drove it across the country and you leave it someplace, they want to get a driver to drive that back to their location. And then it's going to cost you a lot of money to do that. The same way with these replaceable batteries. You're going to have a problem because if people will be dropping these batteries off at random places, and then at some point you're going to have an equity position where these somebody that's getting too many batteries doesn't have any place to get them, put them, to store them. So they're going to have to get them off to somebody who's not getting excess, that has a deficiency of batteries. And that's going to be a lot of transportation, and et cetera. So logistically, the battery issue for electric cars is difficult either way you slice it, whether you go with a permanent battery in a car or if you go with the replaceable batteries. Either way, it's not a good solution. It's one that's difficult for the public to stomach when they're used to spending 5 minutes at the gas station filling up their car and driving away. And then just let me mention also that you have the high-end chargers for the both hydrogen. You have excessively strong pumps that can get you up to 70 the pressure that is required in a hydrogen car. Or the same with an electric car, the level 3 charging stations, which Tesla has its own, the fast chargers, they'll run at 50 kilowatts or more of power. And so in an hour, you're able to put 50 kilowatt hours into your car. So it's a two-hour charge for a Tesla that's running up around 100 kilowatt hours. It's still a couple of hours to charge that car. Compare that to hydrogen, which is 5 to 10 minutes, or gasoline, which is 5 minutes. Okay. So making use of existing gasoline distribution center infrastructure, how do the electric versus hydrogen stack up? And in this respect, let's look at the entire food chain of dealing with hydrogen. Hydrogen, typically, my personal belief is hydrogen can come from many sources. You can crack the hydrocarbon chains. You can get hydrogen out of it. But probably the most promising one in my eyes is the conversion, just the old-fashioned electrolysis and creation of hydrogen that way. It's around 73% efficient, meaning that 73% of the energy you put into it comes out in usable hydrogen coming back to you. But then, of course, you have to pump it, pressurize it. All of the storage is pressurized, which is different than gasoline. And so if you're moving hydrogen around, you have this pressurized tank. But once you get it pressurized, now you're moving it from pressurized tank to pressurized tank, and kind of like the propane issue. You originally have some guy with a great big propane tank. He pressurizes that, gets the propane in there, and then as he fills smaller containers of propane, then it's like liquid flowing in a very high pressure system. But as far as using current infrastructure, it's probably going to be easier for hydrogen to use current gasoline infrastructure, trucking, transportation, and a lot of the hydrogen eventually will come from seaside or ocean facilities. And so that's something also that, because the oceans have literally limitless amount of hydrogen in it in form of water, and converting it back to, it'll end up in water as it is used, hydrogen burning in the oxygen atmosphere, etc. But hydrogen lends itself in the whole chain from the procurement, of hydrogen, which is instead of mining it out of the ground or out of deep caverns in the ground like oil is to convert to gasoline, hydrogen is from surface water, basically. You don't have to go down. You don't have drilling rigs, etc. What you have are basically electrolysis and then pressurizing pumps to pressurize it and then pressurized tanks to distribute it. But the gasoline station scenario is much more amenable to H2 hydrogen than it is to electric, because the electric, the situation is, though, if you look at the growth of charging stations, they typically tend to be nearer where gasoline stations are, because that's where people are used to going to get their car filled up. There's an issue. Now, let's look at some of the infrastructure to deliver power and electricity versus hydrogen in offshore rigs. Now, hydrogen, you don't need any cables that go to shore. You can produce it if you have, say, wind energy, and this is going to be one of the primary uses of the wing generator. But three-blade wind turbines are really not going to produce much hydrogen. And I'll get into that in a couple minutes here. But if you have a offshore rig someplace, you don't need a long cable, and that's turning out to be the downshore of offshore electricity, is because those long electric cables, first of all, it's infrastructure, it's cost, it's very expensive, but the currents in the ocean move them and over time destroy them. They start shorting out, they start moving, etc. They start destroying plant life, etc., if it's on the bottom of the ocean. And these wires have to be continuous all the way to shore to where they come to a facility, and that's a lot of power loss also. So offshore power, one of the bugaboos of offshore electrical power is that cable that connects it to land. And so you see these nice towers out there, and they look like they're spinning, but the real downfall is going to be, and you know, everybody's trying to move towards offshore because there's more wind, it's more consistent when you're in an offshore setting, but then you've got that cable problem. With hydrogen, you do not have a cable problem. You don't have an infrastructure pipe that has to run to shore. What you would have is an onboard pump where you would pump up your tanks right there, and then the big tanker ship would come along and load up and take those the hydrogen to shore. And in that respect, it's very similar to gasoline, where the big tanker ships are bringing oil. The oil goes to the refineries. The refineries crack the oil and make the gasoline, and then that goes out in an infrastructure that's designed to go to gas station. And all of that is set up, and hydrogen is much more amenable to that rather than having offshore wind or even solar, offshore solar they're talking about, but offshore wind with all of the cabling then that goes to the cable distribution and all of the losses and the difficulties with underwater cabling, etc. All of that being a major problem for the electric car scenario. I already talked about 120 volt charging at home, but the once again, the hydrogen at home charging station is not something that most people are going to have. I'll make a quick commentary also, and this is early on in my analysis of the overall, the wing generator and electric cars and very large wing generators, where we would have maybe 2,000 to 3,000 extremely large wing generators of the 250 megawatt variety powering a very large portion of the United States electrically. And that goes out on the infrastructure, and then that's very local. That's localized energy because there are very high wind locales all over the country. And in that respect, charging your car at home would become viable because now you could have a car charging station in every house, and people would come home at night, and while they're sleeping, the car is charging with a fairly significant charging rate. But there again, where is the infrastructure going to come to move all of that electricity? It doesn't exist, and this is one of the other issues that nobody is talking about, especially in when you get up to the government levels, when you get up to alternative energy levels, when you get up to American Wind Energy Association levels, or the Department of, the National Renewable Energy Association or agencies, etc. One thing they don't talk about is the fact that no infrastructure is being built to generate more electricity. There's a little fun fact for you. In the next five years, number one, people who are younger than 13 years old will probably never drive a gasoline automobile. Number two, the demand for electricity because of the conversion to electrical transportation, and this includes airplanes, boys and girls, that's coming, trains, airplanes, motorcycles, everything electric, would create a doubling of demand for electricity in the next 5 years. Nobody is building up the infrastructure to create that level of power. They're struggling now in California to meet the demand on a hot summer day. I've given talks about how much solar panel would take to convert in Los Angeles just to run the air conditioning on a hot summer day. You would have to panel the entire Los Angeles Valley with solar panels just to run the air conditioning on a hot summer day. And that's just when the sun is shining. That doesn't count. When the sun goes down, what are you going to do then? So at any rate, the big downfall of any of this, including hydrogen, because hydrogen requires electrical generation. And like I said, it's 73% efficient. Actually, probably on a par with electricity generation and efficiency. But hydrogen requires electrical generation for electrolysis. And like I say, that's probably going to win out over the long run if hydrogen does make headway into the mass market. It's going to be created offshore by electrical generation plants, or maybe even, and it's not going to be done with nuclear power, it's not going to be done with coal or natural gas, because they simply cannot double the infrastructure at the Central Power Company. They're not even talking about a 1% increase, let alone a 100% increase. So there's some real problems coming down the road here in this thing in Texas, by the way, as I said on this show many times, was a planned event. It was structured. The political environment created that dilemma. It did not have to happen because of rules and regulations set up for the greenies, the woke greenies. They couldn't import any more power. And when the power level, the voltage level went under critical level, the whole thing came crashing down on a nice cold winter day in Texas. Along with this, now something I've worked in part of my life is something called standards. And it took a long time for electric car charging standards to come along to where they have the level one, the level two, and the level three chargers, where they're standardized. And even there you have companies like Tesla that are so big they have their own charger. But you can have an adapter between the standards and the Tesla. But and then also in terms of hydrogen, setting up standards so that everybody is on the same boat. But standards are very important. And to date, we really don't have standards that are amenable with what has to be done relative to electrical charging, etc. The standards of the industries are kind of, they're, what happens, like, let's go back to the film industry. When there was Agfa, the German company, then you had Kodak, the New York company that was making film in the United States. And they had different processes. They had different chemical solutions. There were lots of patents involved in these, but they were very, very restrictive about their processes. And that's the way the situation is right now with electric vehicles. You have General Motors, all the major car companies are coming out with electric vehicles, hybrids, electric vehicles, 100% electric. Then you have new introductions like the RAV and other electric vehicles that are coming on the scene that may make an impression. They may not. They might be things like the Packard that came in for a few years and then went out. The industries are so volatile that in the investments, the way investment is done today, companies are receiving huge investments before they even have a product in some cases. And so therefore, they really are having, the whole industry, what I'm saying is that trying to predict where the industry is going to be in 6 months or a year or in 2 years is impossible. And so this is certainly not good news for somebody that's out there trying to put their money in something. But the one thing, if I were an investor, the one thing that I would be putting my money into is the person who's designed something to generate the electricity. I don't care if you're talking hydrogen. I don't care if you're talking EV, electric car charging. I don't care if you're talking about tractors or if you're talking about the agricultural industry becoming electrified and moving off of diesel, or how about the truck transportation industry moving electric. I don't care which industry you're talking about or which players win or lose there. The one guy that's going to have a lot of business is the guy that can convert wind into electricity. Because you need electricity for hydrogen, whether you're getting hydrogen or you're just charging electric cars with electricity. doubling the demand for electricity in the next 5 years, and nobody is talking about it, nobody is thinking about it, except maybe somebody that's talking on this radio show. That is where the demand is. That is where and that's why the development of energy sources is the next big investment that has to be made. But you know, when you turn things over to politicians, when you turn things over to companies that are stupid, when they are all of these companies should be looking at where they're going to get the power. They want to sell electric cars. What if you had? Let's go back to before the gasoline days, before they took out the streetcars and made everybody individual gasoline automobiles. There was electrical infrastructure that powered trolley cars, and they would drive up and down the street, and they had a little electric fixture up at the top that picked up the electrical current that powered them, and the infrastructure was in place. And they tore all of that out because someone, the Rockefellers and the very large investors in the world, realized that oil was the next big energy source. So they cornered the energy market in oil. Then they came in and they destroyed the infrastructure for electric transportation and forced everybody into getting electric cars, and then the advertising campaigns. And of course, there's nothing like having your own car. I mean, every teenager dreams about the day when they get their first car. So that was an easy sell. That's like falling off the trolley car. Easy. So the way the United States went, but it could have gone with electric cars way that back then. Porsche had an electric car in like 1905. You can go on the internet and see a nice picture of it. It's a very big vehicle. It had a very big battery bank, but a very capable car. And of course, if that would have proceeded and the technology would have gone into infrastructure for that type of automobile, we may have never had gasoline automobiles. And of course, back when the early days of Penn Oil and Shell Oil and the early oil companies, Texaco, etc., they didn't really know how much oil there was. Now we know, and I've talked about this before, that there is so much oil on planet Earth. Back in the mid-1990s, I was talking to geologists that worked for oil companies, and they were being laid off because they had found so much oil that the oil companies could never, ever use it all. Yet you had infrastructure infighting. You had the peak oil thing. You had the oil shortages, how many Nixon had one. There had been 2 or 3 cents then. We're now just re-entering another oil shortage thing. There ain't no oil shortage, never was, never ever was. But if you go back to the beginning of oil, they really didn't know. They did not know, but they knew that there was enough to keep the infrastructure going for the time being. It got them through a couple world wars. Imagine all of the petroleum used in World War I and II, not to mention all the other very profitable wars out there. But now the next thing I want to talk about is building out the grid. So building out the hydrogen infrastructure is one thing, where you have tanks, and that's a big order, where you have pressurized tanks that have enough hydrogen volume where you're running the country's transportation off hydrogen. Requires a massive, massive amount of infrastructure, tanks, pumps, energy, etc., to manage that infrastructure. I don't think anybody could even calculate or estimate the amount of investment it would take to build out hydrogen on a national level. I would feign, and I might be one of the few people that could make a stab at it, but it would really be a difficult thing. And then, of course, with today's pricing, inflation with commodities, you know, all of the infrastructure to build it, the labor, etc., especially with the prices in the United States and labor, etc. Wow. I mean, the cost of installing hydrogen infrastructure at the level necessary for a national program of hydrogen. My goodness. But then again, the grid that produces, that transports electricity in the country, to double the capacity for the electrical grid would require an equally major infrastructural investment. But I will say this, the electrical investment of infrastructure to deliver electricity for electric automobiles, doubling our capacity over the next 5 years, would be easier by many, many factors of 10 than producing infrastructure of hydrogen. But in spite of that, I think hydrogen is going to do very well. I think there's going to be a hydrogen market. I think it's going to grow. And I think that people are going to overcome those financial burdens by, and it's the same thing as gasoline. I mean, you can buy a gallon of gasoline for $3. If you look at the amount of infrastructure, say in an oil rig, you do not have that infrastructure cost with hydrogen. You have two wires coming up into tubes and electricity that's generated from whatever source, and the hydrogen goes off into pumping, and then you might save the oxygen also, or you might just let the oxygen go off into the air. But the amount of infrastructure necessary to create the hydrogen is millions of times, billions of times less than an oil rig or an oil derrick or an on-land oil or the one-armed bandits that scatter the countryside from Oklahoma to who knows where up in, I was just talking with some people up in, where the heck was it? Up in the West Virginia, Ohio area. And they have four or five natural gas pumps on their property. So, you know, no matter what energy source you're looking at, there's a lot of infrastructure involved to get that product in the quantity necessary to the public. And so even though I'm talking about a massive infrastructure expense to move hydrogen into the land, into the infrastructure, it does not have the requirement at the source. The production of hydrogen at the source, which would be out in the ocean, is going to be really small. So you can now afford to build that infrastructure up on land because you're getting your hydrogen at a very base cost. And I'm out of time here. Remember, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. We have the water filter sales are still on, etc., and the education program, very important for people. Once again, that's jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.